Okay, so welcome back, everyone. Just a couple of things that I want to mention. The schedule this afternoon, as you've probably seen, there isn't a coffee break. We've only got two speakers this afternoon, and then I'll be concluding afterwards. I think in terms of the discussions, I think down in the programme there's two discussions assigned. I think probably if okay with you, I think it makes the most sense for us to have questions and discussion after Danny and Sharon's talks, and then I'll do a conclusion after that. And I think that's probably going to make the most sense. And if there's time for questions directed at me after my little piece, then we can do that as well. So for this afternoon, I was kind of interested in presenting two responses to the issues raised this morning and to the False Memory Archive project. I think probably what I'll do to start off with, just to warm us all back up again, is just show you another extract from the FaceTime film that's down at the Freud Museum. Just a couple of minutes.
Okay. Our primary school has a very small teaching kitchen attached to the assembly / lunch hall. I remember at the end of one lunch night, the hall emptying out.
Okay, we've seen this one. It's the next slide, I apologise.
You did that on purpose.
I did that on purpose. Just so that you,
I didn't remember.
And I'm doing this on purpose as well. Here we go. Ready?
Right, so I had a girlfriend. I was convinced that she had a sister who died at the dentist. I even told my whole family about this. And then one day over dinner, she says at the dinner table, she says she's going to the dentist the next week. Everyone around the table went very quiet. And then my mum says, it must be very hard for you. And it never, ever happened. I must have had a dream and then convinced myself that it was real. But I used to keep my own dental appointment secret from her. And I never brought the subject up because I thought, no, she'll talk about it whenever she's ready.
Lulu, the singer, died several years ago. I saw it on TV. I saw the yellow and white flowers in the hearse and the spell out her name. I remember my mum commenting on it, being sad because she was quite young and seeing song clips and the news stories. It's definitely her. I find it so weird when I see her alive.
So, I'm delighted to be introducing to you Professor Danny Nobis, who will be talking to us today about the difficulty of objectively identifying a memory that is false when it's believed subjectively to be true by the person who has the memory, and other things besides. Danny is Professor of Psychology and Psychoanalysis and Provart Vice-Chancellor for Development and External Relations of Brunel University in London, where he directs the MA programme in Psychoanalysis and Contemporary Society. He is the Chair of the Freud Museum London and has published numerous books and papers on the history, theory and practice of psychoanalysis. Please do welcome Danny.
Thank you very much. And my congratulations on this wonderful exhibition, which I only just saw. That's what happens when you're the chair of the Freud Museum, actually. You don't get to see the things anymore. But it's really fantastic, and it is incredibly thought-provoking. So I do hope I will be able to respond to it a little bit, or at least to refer to it on occasion. Much like Martin before lunchtime, I'd like to start with an apology. Actually, two apologies. First of all, I don't have a PowerPoint. And I do realise that after lunch people often experience a bit of a lull in their consciousness. So I will have to maintain your attention simply by virtue of my speech. But so I will thank you in advance for listening, just in case at the end you've all fallen fallen asleep and I won't be able to wake you up. The second apology is a more serious one, and it's to do with the fact that although I did train as a psychologist, I'm by no means a mainstream psychologist. My colleagues at Brunel still think that I'm the astrologist amongst astronomers. Some people say that, with all due respect, that I'm the creationist amongst the Darwinians. But hey, they hired me, right? So, although I'm trained as a psychologist, I have spent most of my life working within a clinical and theoretical psycholytic framework. And I've never done any research on memory along the lines that psychologists would do, although I have read quite a bit of the literature. So what I'm going to present to you may come across as questionable, given that it doesn't draw on my own expertise or even my research, but I will nonetheless try to open some alternative perspectives on what you've heard this morning. At an event like this, I thought it would be entirely appropriate if I started with a memory. I have no idea how much confabulation is involved in it, because unlike with some of the memories that we've seen here, there is actually very little or no factual evidence in support or indeed against what I'm going to say. But I remember in the early 1990s participating in a debate in the States around The Courage to Heal, which I think was published in 1991, if my memory serves me right. And I had no idea that I had been planted there in order to represent everything that was wrong, not just about psychoanalysis, but about all the various sides of the debate. Because I realized afterwards, obviously, but it was an interesting, it was a challenging, and it was a very thought-provoking debate. But it was interesting primarily because, as someone who was representing psychoanalysis, I was pulled between a rock and a hard place, if that's the right expression, because representatives from the the Loftus side, the false memory syndrome paradigm, who were exposing the fallacies of recovered memory therapy, accused psychoanalysis of fueling, feeding, and facilitating that kind of work. Whereas the representatives of the recovered memory theory paradigm were actually accusing psychoanalysis, and Freud in particular, for abandoning the seduction theory, and therefore not believing in the reality of sexual abuse. So there I was. Right. Okay, what am I going to do now? But I survived, and it actually prompted me to look more critically into the arguments for and against, and to think probably in a more in-depth way about what psychoanalysis, and of course Freud in particular, has to say about memory. I won't have time today to take you through all that, but there are some traces of the debate in the literature. Fred Cruz, the old Freud basher, published two very controversial articles in a New York Review of Books around the time, which attracted many comments that were subsequently collected in a book called The Memory Wars, and it still makes for a very interesting reading, I think. Right. As I was preparing for this talk, and I'm going to try and be brief and leave a good space and time for discussion. As I was preparing for this talk, I actually came to the conclusion that, one, the debate around memory as it is regarded by psychoanalysts and where they stand within the whole false memory discussion has died down a little bit. It's by no means as vehement anymore as it was back then, which probably says more about how the debate is no longer as polarized anymore as it used to be. But it may also say something about how psychoanalysts themselves have reviewed and reconsidered their own perspective on memory. Secondly, I noticed that actually, when it comes to considering memories, psychoanalysts would probably agree with much of the work that's been done in the area of neuropsychology. And listening to my colleagues, the experts this morning, at no given point did I think, what? This is outrageous! I mean, we can talk until the cows come home about the status of repression in Freudian theory, but on the whole, I thought, you know what, we could probably agree with this. What I try to do in the end is to unpack and unpick and unfold the issue of falsity, if that's a good word, fictitiousness, a little bit. So I'm not going to focus on memory, because that's not where my expertise lies. I'm going to focus on how we actually establish, or whether we can establish altogether, that a memory is false. And I'll start with a general statement. From a psychoanalytic point of view, and of course psychoanalysis is no longer a unitary paradigm, I do accept that, but for the sake of the argument, I will act as if it is, and I will not talk about Kleinians and Lacanians and Winnicottians and Freudians and Spotnitzians and what have you. Those exist too, and they have nothing to do with alien abduction, by the way. That's another story I might share with you later. So I will act as if psychoanalysis constitutes a relatively well integrated body of ideas. Okay, from a psychoanalytic point of view, I think it would be fair to say that the process of remembering, and I'm not talking about the memory function here, but the process of remembering never generates perfectly accurate memories. Why? I can think of at least three reasons. One, recall relies on the retrieval of fragments of historical experience. Bruchstücke, Freud would have called them. As in fragments of a case of hysteria. It relies on fragments of historical experience and events, which are then pieced together with what I could call the glue of creative imagination. So when remembering, we are therefore, we as human beings, from a psychological point of view, like the archaeologists of our own history. And you know that Freud was very interested in archaeology, and he was surrounded by objects. We are the archaeologists of our own history, delving into our past, collecting remnants here and there, and piecing them together creatively into a more or less coherent and consistent, quote-unquote, unified memory. Two. So the second reason I could think of, as a psychoanalyst, as to why the process of remembering never generates perfectly accurate memories, is that the way in which a historical event is recalled is affected, literally and metaphorically. It is affected by our emotional investment in it. I mean, Freud never considered representations, Vorstellungen, without also considering the affect quantum. Right? So for Freud, those two always go together. Sometimes there are disconnections, or what he called falsche Verknüpfungen, which literally means false knots. But so on the whole, a representation is associated with an affect. But this affectation actually affects the way in which the process of remembering takes place. And there is quite a bit of research in psychology I've been able to establish, although I've had to be able to disentangle it, because it's quite complex. But there is research in psychology showing that the degree of accuracy with which we remember is also, and perhaps primarily, a function of our emotional attachment to the experience and the events. Right? So we could say that emotion, the affect quantum, as Freud would have had it, filters recollection. And I would be tempted to argue that only those recording and recall processes that take place in an affect-less state would perhaps be able to guarantee perfect accuracy. Which wouldn't say anything, of course, about the ease with which something is recalled. Emotionally neutral events may effectively be much more difficult to recall than emotionally charged ones, but be that as it may, complete emotional neutrality is probably a state that we as human beings are probably never going to achieve. Right? So if you take into account that the affect quantum, it filters the and affects literally the process of recollection, then that in itself, I thought, would be an argument to say that accuracy, complete accuracy, may be an illusion or something that we can only achieve asymptotically. Thirdly, and perhaps most importantly, the encoding, the etching, if you want, the preservation and the recall of events and experiences for a psychoanalyst, but I think my colleagues in psychology would agree, is not just a physiological process. It's also a linguistic process. It's a linguistic process that draws on symbolic reconstruction, that draws on narrativization, and which is therefore, by definition, superimposed as a fiction, you could say, upon this real event and or experience. Nonetheless, we continue to refer to certain memories as false and others as true. As if there were such a thing as a perfectly accurate, truthful human memory function. Now, the first thing to note in this respect is that the designation of a memory being false is, in general, a judgment that is based on a comparison of the content of the memory and the nature of the historical experience or events that is being recalled. The stronger the discrepancy between the content of the memory and the nature of the historical event that is being recalled, the more false, the more inaccurate, the more inauthentic a memory is, and vice versa, one could say. The falsest memory, then, would then be the memory of the event that never happened. So I guess most of these false memories here are not just a little bit false. They are considered to be very false, extremely false, because they refer to events that never happened. And I'll come back to that in a minute, as to how do you establish that something never happens. Right? And I'll talk a bit more about this correspondence criterion that Martin mentioned before lunch. As one of the criteria that one can use for establishing truthfulness or indeed fictitiousness of concepts and memory contents. Now, I will leave it up to the memory psychologists to explain how exactly false memories form, but I think a number of points are worth mentioning. And some of you may have seen this film. As Akira Kurosawa showed in Rashomon, consciously crafted false memories, or Martin called intentional false autobiographical memory. Is that correct? IFAMs, right? IFAMs. May be driven purely by self-interest. People seem to be able and quite willing to make up stories whilst allegedly remembering things that are deliberately economical with the truth in order to exculpate themselves or with a view to portraying themselves in a certain positive light. 2. IFAMs, having consciously crafted false memories, may, of course, as we know, also be associated with an underlying clinical condition. Right? And we've only touched a little bit upon the clinical conditions, but I think this is a whole area of research and study that we somehow need to try and build into research on false memories. They may be associated with an underlying clinical condition, and they may then effectively take over a subject's entire lived experience. I think the psychiatrists used to call it mythomania, or Pseudologia Fantastica. The most famous example, or one of the most notorious examples, is that of Benjamin Wilkomirski, who in 1995 published a memoir called Fragments. It was a memoir of his surviving the concentration camps of Majdanek and Birkenau, which was subsequently discovered to be inauthentic. So Wilkomirski's publisher, German publisher, commissioned an investigative journalist to actually look into the accuracy of the historical events that he was describing, and before long, it was found that actually Wilkomirski had never been in a concentration camp, and that he had made everything up, which created an enormous amount of discussion around the veracity, the truthfulness of memory in relation to Holocaust survival stories. 3. Consciously accepted, yet unconsciously crafted false memories, as we heard this morning, can of course be implanted and manipulated by external authority figures, as the controversy surrounding RMT and FMS from the early 90s is demonstrating. 4. The persistence of false memories also doesn't seem to be conditioned by the extent to which the rememberer believes in them. And indeed, Giuliana Mazzoni has done very interesting research on this. Just because someone stops believing in certain childhood memories, for example, because he's been told by a parent that the event couldn't have happened, does not seem to be deactivating the memory, right? Which is something that psychoanalysts are very interested in. Right? So, because if you put it into the perspective of what I said earlier on, of the affect quantum and the emotional charge, something happens with reference to the emotional charge of the event if you stop believing in it. But that doesn't seem to affect at all the actual process of them recurring and those memories continuing to be active. At this point, I'd like to emphasize that regardless of these complications and complexities surrounding false memory, that what makes a memory false, and I've said it earlier on, is in most cases the extent to which it corresponds to an actual event. The extent. What lies at the basis of this judgment, then, is exactly the same criterion as the one that has been used by natural scientists since the golden age of science to establish the truth value of a scientific observation. It's the so-called correspondence criterion of truth. Adequatio rei et intellectus, they used to call it in the 17th century. Something, an idea, a mental representation, a memory, is true if and only if it corresponds to, is adequate with regard to the things in the outside world. Now, this is but one of many criteria that philosophers of science and epistemologists have used and continue to employ in order to assess the truth value of ideas and observations. You've heard this morning Martin talk about the coherence criterion, which is sometimes also called the consistency criterion. But there is, for example, the consensus criterion. Right? I mean, one of the things that people who claim to have been abducted by aliens, or one of the things that those people who have memories of alien abduction claim, is that because there seems to be I'm not going to say a wide consensus, but some consensus about it, that therefore it must be true. Needless to say, this is a weaker criterion than the correspondence criterion. Because you may say, well, 10,000 people can be wrong. Well, I guarantee you, 10,000 people can be wrong. Right? And there is no doubt on those occasions also an element of intersuggestibility, you see. But it would be another way of looking at the veracity status of memories. Is there a consensus around it or not? And if there isn't, it must be false. But you see, even if there is, it might still be false. There is a pragmatic criterion. Pragmatist philosophers have said, well, something is true if it works. Now, you can apply that with reference to the false memory debate and say, well, if a memory that someone constructs, consciously or unconsciously, works for that particular person at that particular moment in his or her life, then that's enough for us to say it's true. You see? And there is, of course, a falsifiability criterion, which was introduced by Popper in the 1930s, i.e. if you can't falsify it, then you know this, right? We should ring the bells of victory every time a theory is refuted. Okay? By which you obviously say, well, and because you can't do it with psychoanalysis is therefore not a science, etc. But outside the realm of science, philosophers have come up with their own distinct and highly divergent views as to what constitutes truth, right? I'm a good Roman Catholic boy, and I still remember people telling me, the only thing that is true is God, right? It's in St. Augustine. Where is truth? It's at the level of God. All the rest you have reason to doubt, but not God. For Kant, of course, it's reason. For Nietzsche, it's fiction. For Badiou, it's an event. Now, psychoanalysts, starting with Freud, I won't go on for much longer. Psychoanalysts, starting with Freud, have always been very skeptical of the correspondence criterion when it comes to assessing the truth value of memories. More fundamentally, I could say, psychoanalysts, starting with Freud, have always been rather skeptical of truth per se. Right. Which of course has been used against them, but I think if there is one thing that sets psychoanalysis apart from other disciplines, is that truth doesn't feature that highly on the agenda, actually. Many other things do, and even when Lacan in the 50s kind of reactivates this whole notion of truth, for which he was then called to be steering into the realm of metaphysics, it is generally to unpack it, to unpick it, to criticize it. Freud intermittently professed his love for truth. The term Wahrheitsliebe features in Freud's work. Yet at the same time, he was extremely doubtful about the possibility of representing things as they really are, in accordance with the correspondence criteria. And it's well known in this respect how in the early 30s Freud claimed that psychoanalysis is not in itself a Weltanschauung, it's not a view of the world, but should adopt the scientific Weltanschauung, as opposed to, say, the philosophical one, which he hated, precisely because he thought science to be not a closed, totalizing and totalized system of knowledge, but rather something that is open-ended. Something in which truth is always being reviewed and reconsidered and never fully finalized. In other words, Freud regarded truthfulness more as representative of an intrinsically fractured state of human knowledge. Being truthful, it would not be about representing things as they really are, a perfect correspondence between a particular and a universal, between essence and existence, Heidegger would say. Being truthful is about acknowledging that all efforts at representation, including the one called remembering, are doomed to fail. So in a sense, you could say from a psychoanalytic perspective, something is true if it acknowledges that it's intrinsically false. Why? Owing to the intrinsic limits of symbolic representability when it comes to recollecting and representing experiences and events. Now, this principle applies equally to the way in which a Freudian psychoanalyst would conceptualize memory and to the way in which a patient's memories would be approached in a psycholytic treatment setting. Whether a memory is true or false has nothing to do, then, with the extent to which it corresponds to an external reality, but with the extent to which the memory is acknowledged as inherently fictional. Right? So truthfulness is a measure of the degree to which a memory is recognized as an intrinsically fractured representation of an actual event. Within psychoanalytic practice, the psychoanalyst would not encourage, then, the patient to engage in a process of reality testing. We do not do that. Let alone perform the reality testing for the patient and present him or her with the results of that investigation. During the 1950s, Lacan exposed the dangers of this type of psychic reality testing extensively in his critique of American ego psychology. And more specifically, some of you may have read that paper, in a deeply critical analysis of a paper by Ernst Chris called Ego Psychology and Interpretation in Psychic Therapy. I'll very briefly tell you what the case is about. Ernst Chris, who is very well established, or was a very well established psychoanalyst at the time, talks about a patient, a young academic, who comes to see him because he can't publish. And the man can't publish, and we know how bad that is if you're an academic. He couldn't publish because he felt that he was always plagiarizing someone else's work. And at one point he comes to see Chris and he says, look, I've done it again, and I do it against myself, right? He says, I don't consciously, intentionally want to do it, but it just happens. Help. So he shows Chris, I'm summarizing, I'm probably making up God knows how many details. Yeah. The more I talk about it, the more I think, no, that actually comes to carry on. I'll just carry on anyway. But so he comes to see Chris and he shows Chris a paper and he says, look, I've done it again. So this is plagiarized. And Chris says, give me the details of the book from which you think you've plagiarized, right? And the patient is like, right, okay. He said, no, give me the details. So he writes down the details, and Chris, he goes to look in the library. Right? He takes the patient's paper, and he looks at the book, and he compares them, and he comes to the conclusion there's no plagiarism. So the next session, he says to the patient, you know what, I checked it for you, you're fine. Patient has a massive panic attack. Right? So it's the type of reality testing that psychoanalysts do not or are not supposed to do. And Lacan says, look, whether the guy in question plagiarized or not, as in whether it constituted a natural event, doesn't matter. What matters is at that very moment, his recollection of plagiarizing fulfilled a certain function of truth for this patient. And it's not of the psychoanalyst to actually take that away. Right? So, if you take all this into account, and you then say that inasmuch as all autobiographical memories are to some extent objectively false, because they are filtered by emotions, they are embedded in a symbolic linguistic narrative, and they are pieced together like an archaeological pot with the glue of the creative imagination. So if you agree that they don't correspond exactly to how events and experiences actually happened, but always contain a certain degree of confabulation, maybe they're also, to some extent, always subjectively true. Which, interestingly, is not the case, of course, with these, because they're actors, right? But you tend to forget. Mm. And you probably did that deliberately. But when I went to see it just now, I knew that you had asked two actors to recite false memories. And the memories are false because, in this case, it's you know, there's no correspondence. They've been able to establish their fictitiousness on account of confirming their lack of correspondence with an actual event. But they're twice false, you see? They're also false because they're recited by actors. Right? But maybe the actors in this question are so good at reciting them, not just because they're actors, but also because these memories somehow ring true in their own experience. I don't know. I mean, we're going to talk about that. But I thought it was an interesting duplicity there in terms of the falseness of the actual memory. There is always an element of subjective truth, because they represent, at the end of the day, let's face it, the mental activity of a subject who is remembering or who accepts the memories when they are being implanted and manipulated by a third party. Yet much as psychoanalysis doesn't facilitate high levels of correspondence, psychoanalysis also doesn't work, in my humble opinion, towards high levels of authenticity at the point where memories are subjectively true. Encouraging patients to recognize and accept their unassailable subjective truth at each and every point of their autobiographical memories. I mean, in some scientific traditions, I guess they would do that. They're not working towards higher levels of authenticity. But I think in a traditional, or I should say in a classic Freudian paradigm, that type of, well, I would call it enlightened existential or humanistic approaches would not be on the agenda either. What psychoanalysis focuses on then, in the clinical realm, primarily, is the boundary between what I would call objective falsity and subjective truth. And we talked a bit about that over lunch. There is a boundary, but you can't pinpoint it. It's shifting, and it's at that boundary line that the work takes place. So it is between these poles of autobiographical memory that we also need to, of course, appreciate then the role of desire, the role of fantasy, or what I would call the role of the creative imagination. Now, at this point, and I'm almost at the end, at this point, and I could have called this paper an ode to creative imagination, but I'll tell you in a minute, and you probably recognize it, why it's called, it's a poor sort of memory that only works backwards. I would like to share another memory. About 5 years ago, although it may have been 7 years ago, I can't remember exactly when, about 5 years ago, I was invited to participate in an expert workshop, yet another expert workshop where I was not an expert, on the work of David Grossman. I love it. You know, it's like on the work of David Grossman, who's a very well-established, famous Israeli writer. And the workshop was about a book called Sea Under Love, which was first published in Israel in 1986, a book which tells the story of Momik, who in turn tells the story of the Holocaust, and of his ancestors, who are in themselves storytellers. Now, when I accepted to participate in this workshop, I thought, I always say yes, by the way, to these things, especially when I feel I'm not an expert, because it's such a wonderful excuse to talk nonsense. You can always say, well, actually, I'm not an expert, you know. Ask him, I don't know anything about this, what do I know? But you know what, they invited me anyway. But I invited to participate in this workshop without being an expert, but I did think, actually, because the subject was the Holocaust, right? And I thought, what authorizes me to do this? Because I'm a Roman Catholic boy. My parents have some memory of the Germans invading Belgium, but, you know, that's as far as it got. So I thought, I mean, who am I to talk about the Holocaust? And then I read about David Grossman, and interestingly, when he published a book, some Israeli critics stated that David Grossman should also not have written about the Holocaust. Because they said, well, he hasn't been there, right? Only people who have been in concentration camps have the right to remember. And it's a very interesting discussion, I think. So Grossman's critics effectively restricted the authority, the authorization, the authorship, you could say, of writing about the Holocaust to those who could rely on autobiographical memory. So they felt the need to restrict literary fantasy and narrative imagination in favor of what they believe to be historical veracity and authenticity, as if truthfulness can and should exist outside the fundamental fictional dimension of all storytelling, which we psychoanalysts don't believe, you see. As Lacan says somewhere, and I do believe it, but, you know, you don't have to, you can't really access truth without having recourse to a structure of fiction, because you have to represent it. And in the very act of representing it, you have recourse to elements that are not intrinsically part of the event that you want to describe. It's the whole discussion about the real and symbolic, etc. Right? So, in other words, it was stated there that one cannot write truthfully about something one hasn't experienced personally, and mutatis mutandis, that only lived experience may generate and allow for the production of truthful accounts, uncontaminated by fictional interpretations of circumstances and events. Now, I think it's precisely this perspective on autobiographical memory and its underlying criteria of what constitutes truth and falsity that a psychoanalytic approach may help to unpack. not in the service of a reappreciation of subjective idealism. I don't want to go into a Kantian mode here and say, yes, subjective truth is everything, and the world is only has ideas and a priori categories of space and time, and etc., etc., but with a view to situating and appreciating what mediates between the objective and the subjective. And this mediating factor, this vanishing mediator, you could say, is, in my humble opinion, nothing more, nothing less than the function of creative imagination, or, if you want, the function of fantasy. Now, in giving this dimension its rightful place in autobiographical memory, and that's why I could call it an ode to creative imagination, I think autobiographical memory is really enriched. You know, creative imagination, especially when it's called confabulation, has been given a bad press. You know, there's something about confabulation that smells badly. Right? We are not supposed to confabulate. You know, it stinks. It hurts. It's not truthful. I disagree. I think creative imagination, call it confabulation if you want, is as much an essential part, and I do mean essential, of who we are and what we represent as human beings as everything else. But I also think that if you revalue creative imagination, autobiographical memory, you actually enrich memory with a future-oriented temporal dimension. So quoting the White Queen in Alice in Wonderland, you can indeed say that it is a poor sort of memory that only works backwards. That's what she says to Alice, right? But Alice is a bit confused, right? But it seems to me that the only way to avoid it only working backwards is by looking beyond truth and falsity as measures of correspondence, because inevitably then you look backwards, right, to see whether the event really happened, and bringing out this creative dimension, which is in a sense also what you've done in your work of art, right? So that's the third layer, you could say, of falsity. The first layer is that the memories that are being recited are false because they didn't correspond with an actual event, right? The second layer is that they are recited by actors who themselves could not have had the memory, but the third layer is you yourself as the artist, right? Who pieces everything together also with the glue of your own creative imagination. And I think it's at the interstices between these three levels of falsity that something important can happen. So, you know, bringing out the creative dimension here, I would say, is crucially important, because that does not exclusively situate a subject in a process of historical reconstruction, in a process of retrospective determination. The creative dimension opens up a space of subjective freedom, and we cannot, we should not restrict that. Because what you get there, Lacan called it, it's a dimension of le futur antérieur, of the future anterior. It's about what will have been in light of what is taking place now as a reflection upon our past, right? And you only get that if you appreciate that between objective falsity and subjective truth, there is another dimension at work, which is fundamentally creative, but therefore nonetheless important, and maybe even more important than everything else. That was way too long, but I'll leave it there. Thank you for not falling asleep.
Another great talk. Thank you, Danny. That was really, really interesting. Please write your questions down. We're going to move straight on to Sharon. I've just got to line up the talk. Just bear with me. So, on to the final speaker of the day, Sharon Kibland. So, I've known Sharon for a really long time. 20 years. Nearly 20 years, would you believe? She was a tutor of mine during my BA in Fine Arts at Sheffield Hallam. And not only is she a great artist,
She's also, I think, probably the unhung. But I'm going. I'm just going to stop there. She's unhung.
Yeah. She's.
Right, any questions? She's the unsung. Unsung hero.
Who is it? The unhung.
Unhung zero. She's the unhung zero of. I know. What can you do? Of arts education in the UK. She's informed, challenged, and inspired a remarkable number of emerging and mid-career artists. And her demand for theoretical rigour has, I think, stood many of us who studied under her in good stead. Sharon is an artist and writer. She's a reader in fine art at Sheffield Hallam. And her work considers what is put at stake by art, politics and psychoanalysis. I think today Sharon's going to have a bit of fun with us. It's quite performative and I think a wonderful way to end the day. So will you please welcome Sharon Kibler.
I'm a bit worried about the technical thing, so if you could move this back. Can you hear me? Right. If my voice drops down a bit, do indicate. I'll probably ignore you, but after doing this. I'm really glad that Danny got the graveyard shift after lunch, because what follows him and his lively presentation may be a little soporific. Last year. Today, which was over 2.5 weeks ago, I made myself start to write this for today, which was still 2.5 weeks in the future. I'd been putting it off, of course, but as I engaged in all the usual small evasive acts of deferral, you know, the ironing, weeding something in the garden where there were no weeds, taking ticks off the dogs, that sort of thing, I was thinking about how to begin, and I forgot the name of my psychoanalyst. Now, I thought that I might remember it, perhaps today, this today, if not that one, then the day I knew it had escaped me. You will have to know what I've done, so that you may know what I'm doing now. So I'm going to call the first section of what follows. Actually, no, I'm going to play you a bit of music first, because you'll have to remember this for later. Marienbad, made by Luc Lagier, entitled Dans le Labyrinthe de Marienbad. And following. Do I have
just,
to.
Just press that one.
But where do I point it?
Just up anyway.
Anyway. And following Lagier's film, after its model, there are going to be four sections. I saw L'année dernière à Marienbad in 1975. Alain Robbe-Grillet and Alain René agreed about everything they discussed during their first meeting, which might have been in 1959, or perhaps it was in 1960. Robbe-Grillet knew of René's work and admired its rigour of composition, its resistance to compromise. He did not think that René had the same response to his work. He recognised in it something of his own attempts towards a hieratic quality in gesture and word, an echo of his own rigidity or slowness of attitude, creating a work between an opera and a statue. Both of them, he felt, constructed the mental spaces of time and memory without any excessive insistence on relation of cause and effect or the time sequence in narrative. These words are not quite my own, but I don't remember where I read them. And in fact, thinking of Chris's patient, after that session, he goes out and there's a restaurant next door where the menu is posted up and he orders fresh brains for lunch. But I do remember that Rob Grier writes about normal film action. And while I cannot be more precise, it's along the lines of the way a telephone rings, then is answered. Then something else occurs, set in motion by the simple act of answering the call that precedes it. He doesn't like this, of course, and while I would like it, I'm unable to construct my remembering in this way, like history, as it said, one fucking thing after another. Now, which is the thing I'm pressing again here?
So the circle.
The circle, yes.
And you just press that one there.
The one next to it.
Yeah, that's it.
So you do. Now, hardly a year has gone by in which I have not seen the film at least once. But each time I fall asleep at precisely the same point. So I have, to date, never seen the film in time. I went to Marienbad in 1994, then again in 1996. It is, of course, really Mariensky Lázná, and it was not at all the location of the film, nor is it the place in which the film is set. For Marienbad, a town that no longer exists on the map, is somewhere else last year, where a man tells a woman they met and fell in love. The film was made in 1961. Now, I've forgotten the origin of my compulsion to repeat, yet out of habit I fall asleep anyway. And this is what I'll do, what I have done, what will have been done. I will have watched the film, and when I fall asleep, after I wake, I will try and remember what I've seen, what I will have seen. I will run the film backwards in my remembering and then forwards in my recounting. I'm running the film backwards. No, it will be more like a series of flashbacks through which I will have reconstructed a film that I think is about memory from memory. Now, I hoped I would not this time, these times, always fall asleep at the same point, as has been my habit, for it is a habit I should break if I am not to be frozen by its repetition. This would be very dull for you anyway, and equally so for me. But I hoped I would fall asleep, however, for if I were to stay awake, I would have to watch the whole film, and I could never remember it all. And I'm forgetting it already. Once again, I was more tired than I thought. Only 8 minutes of the film went by before I nodded off. I tried to return to the beginning, wind back, flashback, locate the scenes in their chronological place. There is sonorous music whispering over the credits, the frames of which transform to become real frames. I'm unable to reproduce the intricate detail of Rob Grier's script given to René before the start of shooting, in which nothing is left out, but in which there are discrepancies with the film, between the account of the film and the actuality of a film as seen, and to which I add my account of a film as seen and as forgotten as much as it is remembered. There is a simple dialogue between a man and a woman. One suggests, the other resists. Then it is as though it has always been. It is artificial, staged, and then it is clear it is a stage, but not at first. The camera continues in a long, slow, uniform movement along a dark... This should be black. Just imagine the dark black screen, along a dark gallery of which only one side is seen, while a voice describes a setting at odds with the images on the screen. There's something about walls covered in ornaments from another century, black woodwork, gilding and mirrors. There are trompe l'oeil capitals, false doors, false columns and painted perspectives, black filigree details of metalwork echo the medallion forms of the mirrors, the stucco mouldings of the ceiling. It is a huge Baroque hotel, a dismal Baroque hotel where room follows room, corridor follows corridor. There are framed paintings, silent rooms, closed corridors, a whispering voiceover barely heard at times over the organ music. The voice I know to be that of Robrier, though it may be that of the actor in what will be revealed as taking place against a painted backdrop, but it is not. René recorded all the dialogue in Robrier's voice. That is to say, all the male characters speak like him. René made them listen to Robrier's voice during filming, as though it were a matter only of them reproducing it. There is a framed engraving that shows the grounds of the chateau before we are to encounter them, and in another place. There is a handbill, yes, it is after all a play, and the film endures the length of a theatre piece, 1 hour and 31, or 1 hour and 33 minutes. The bill advertises Rosmer. No, not Rosmer home, as I once thought, though there will be a chiming clock and a departure, as in Ibsen's play, for which there is an audience, men and women sitting in pairs, elegantly dressed, cocktail dresses, black gloves to the elbow. Certain people stand out. A dark woman who will tell her companion to be quiet or to be still again and again as he repeats himself, but not yet, not in this scene. A blonde woman with a necklace of a double row of crystals, a man standing, white shirt, black jacket, bow tie, whom I know will be the husband or supposed husband, son called only M, of the woman I have not yet seen, played by Delphine Seri, who will be called only A, who will have her own voice, not that of Robrier, who will soon appear. We must wait a little. Can you see this? Shall I move this bottle? Perhaps Alistair, you could do that. Leaning against the wall, her arm raised to her shoulder, in a gesture that will become characteristic. Where am I? I drifted away here. I was not, I think, concentrating on what I was watching. I did not let myself be carried along, although I do not think it was a matter of resistance. I retained that image and these. The play ends, the curtain falls, rises, falls again, the spectators stand up, applaud. A is in the same position as the actress on the tiny stage. No, that is a little later. The light has changed, the view's changed, and the camera follows. No, moves around a series of rooms. It circulates, and conversations rise and fall, while each time the conversation is preceded by a pause, as though the frame has been frozen. And the dialogue comes from nowhere, mid-sentence, and X, yes, X, who will be the hero of the film, looks at a couple. No, they're in a mirror, they're seen in a mirror, who circulate, plaintive, the man, that is, whom the woman tells to be still, to be silent. There are small tables where men are playing card games, and M tells X he knows a game, and he always wins it, even when he loses, and the sound of the cards as they are laid down is very loud. I did not understand the game. I do not understand the game. A is unseen, but she laughs, and then she is seen, but she's not laughing, though her laughter is heard. The hubbub of a room and gentle dance music. X and A dance, and M watches them. The music gets louder. A sudden cut, very sudden. There are men in a row in a shooting gallery. They do not move. And then they fire their guns at regular intervals. It is a violent sound. The garden. The description of a garden in Fredericksburg. Last year. And he loved already to hear her laugh. The garden. A view of a garden. But perhaps I've seen it before. Is it here or earlier? I am lost. A stands in a doorway, her left hand raised to her right shoulder. And later I will correct it, this, for it is raised to her left shoulder. She is wearing a black evening dress, and then she appears in a brocade suit and walks along a corridor seen at a distance. The voice comes from off-screen as the camera moves into A's face, which is calm. Robrier described it as varnished. And she says to X, makes a mistake, they have not met, she is not the person he thinks. The film has a varnished quality, It A, is the film, perhaps, is the cinema screen, but this thought passed. The hotel is in a permanent present, though the guests speak of the past. A is on the stairway, another black evening gown, this time with flowing sleeves, and she is alone until the camera moves to the right of the screen, and X watches A, then it moves again, and there are others in the frame. The camera stops moving, the circular movement ends, but when did it begin exactly? Muffled counting. There is an empty box of matches, a game around a polished table, a game with 16 matches laid out on the polished table, and one remains, and X looks up at M against a tone of objective narration. And once again, everything was deserted. 25 minutes. Setting out the pieces. Remember, it was in the gardens of Frederiksberg. That is the timbre of the film. No matter who speaks, with the exception of A, who has her own voice, but not her own words. Groups of people simply not moving. The camera's movement makes them strange. Other groups through the salons and galleries, gleaming images. I must admit I was distracted while watching the film today. The today, that is, of Thursday the 6th of June. The telephone rang and I answered it. Had a conversation while keeping an eye on the action, so to speak. I found myself inventing scenes, tableaux or exchanges, which come from other memories. I've deleted these. But I knew we were in the garden. No, we were not in the garden, but A&M were in the garden. They're in the garden several times, this year and last year. Leaving already? They are in a ballroom. She walks down a long path holding her shoe in her hand. Then there is a group in conversation or not speaking, and she laughs. He says it is with irony, and she's wearing a black dress, not the white one in which she walked on the gravel path, the noise of which I think I heard when she turned on the stairs. Turned back to look at him walking up to Orsa. This, like all I remember, is obscure. An image like a still photograph, yes, but a glossy image that does not evoke a series of thoughts or feelings. I was unable to decode these shiny views, which might be of some use in an analysis, but seem somewhat of a failure in my attempt to remember a story precisely and to retell it, as though you will have seen it yourselves. M is telling A a story to punctuate, rupture the frozen stillness of the hotel and its guests, where any movement is simply repetition. He is constructing a history, a love story, as if only love can release her or animate her. She has forgotten what did not happen, and I have forgotten what happens. It could have been last year or longer. She has never been to Frederiksberg. He's waited for her a long time. In your dreams, she says. It could have been at Carlsbad or Marienbad or Baden-Salza. I've left out a card game. He exerts himself to force words and their images upon her so they impress, like mémoire involontaire. When something appears as inexplicable, one does tend to elaborate to provide an association to fill the space where sense is lost. A screen memory, for Freud, is not a memory at all, but a screen for an inaccessible memory. Often a film seems natural, but this varnished film does not. They were talking about anything, the statues, the water, or they were not talking at all. They are not in the garden, but in the hotel bar. Usually at night, she did not like to talk. There is a flash, a scene of the bedroom, again, then the bar, then the bedroom, each time held longer, until she is seen in the bedroom, sitting holding her shoe with a broken strap, shoes scattered around her, Now, this is usually where I fall asleep. But of course, and some of you will say this is repression at work, I did not fall asleep this time. 37 minutes, 22 seconds. One evening, I went up to your bedroom. I was still awake. Organ music, the same. She looks up, laughs, says laughter, it's off screen. A glass shatters and there's silence. Match game. Whispering on the stairs. The walls were always there and conversations took place in a vacuum. Always the same conversations, the same missing words. The game was silent. Be quiet, shut up, taisez-vous. Others think they remember, but it is about the weather. X tells A, reflected in the mirror, that it was so cold last year that the fountains froze. A shot of the garden, the balustrade. One night he went to her room. She was alone. He begs her to leave him. She begs him to leave her. Laissez-moi. It was winter. He accompanied her. They walk down the corridor. He walks on as she turns to her husband, to M, then rejoins X, and the voiceover says something like the story is already over. Frozen. A concert. The garden with topiary and figures. You all know this image. My God, he kisses her and holds her left breast. Leave me, she begs. She holds her left hand to her shoulder. At the concert, then is in a salon. X sits at the next table, and she never seemed to be waiting for him. This part was very clear to me, for she is listening to him as he describes the garden in which they walk. He asks her to come nearer, on the balustrade, and her varnished face fills the screen. He tells her she is here, where he has taken her, and she asks him who he is. And he tells her, it does not matter. Laissez-moi, laissez-moi. It was impossible for her to leave with him. She was waiting for no one. It is, he says, a question of her life. Unable to move backwards or forwards. And he describes her then, and she echoes it now, eyes closed, as M approaches from the shadows. M, who is perhaps her husband, but then he is not there. Yes, X said, he preferred to go. A cut, the imaginary bedroom, which is no longer the same room. Mirrors, a glass like the one that was broken. The glass that was broken, remember, it shattered, and he picked up the pieces in a cloth. Again, he comes to her room. 71 minutes. The game begins. I could remember absolutely nothing. Now, if you accept that I've been constructing each part of this from memory, if that is indeed the truth, I should not attempt any invention. I waited a long time that day trying to remember. The longer I watched the film, the more difficult it was to remember its events. What had just happened receded as I had to start again each time where I had ended the time before. What was closest to me was forgotten as I tried to retrieve the past. There are some things, such as last year, know it's impossible, and that A speaks in a very animated way to X. But before that I think she has screamed in the bedroom, the room that keeps changing, and she describes the room to X, and he tells her that he does not remember anymore, that he does not remember himself. He wants her to leave. Yes, she must leave this time. He shows her a photograph. It is of her in the garden. Non, non, c'est impossible. But he insists that she's ready to leave. He tells her that he loves her. And as she walks away, she's drawn back to him, as though his words may pull her to him. The bedroom, she lies down on the bed again and again. M, who may be her husband, enters, and the end is replayed at least, and the entry is replayed at least once. He interrogates her. He finds the photograph. She was reading a book in the green salon, and the photograph is in the book, but he didn't see her there. He'll go to the gun room, although it's too late. And this happens, and I have not seen it before. He takes out a gun and shoots A, and she's a body in white feathers against the bed. One arm reaching up for your hair. 131 minutes. Fin. End game. No, this is not the right ending. A weekend had passed. I re-entered the film with reluctance, taking up the session where I'd left off. Oh, I wrote session. Did you get that? I meant, of course, to write section. I had to return always to the place I ended the last time, in a double forgetting. Against a wall, a doorway. A has not stayed anywhere this long, and X runs his hand down her throat, and she turns from him. He asks her what she remembers, but she's tired. Laissez-moi! In the grand salon, another game with domino pieces replacing the matches between X and M. No, that was later, and now they're looking at each other, watched by A in the doorway in a black lace dress. And X approaches her from the corridor, though he was sitting in the salon the moment before. In the bedroom, wearing her feathered robe, A opens the drawer of the dressing table, and it is full of photographs. The same photographs, the evidence of her in the garden. Always the same photograph, always last year. In the garden, there is the sound of footsteps on the gravel. In the grand salon, another game is played, with domino pieces replacing the matches, a complement of seven. But I don't know what that means, and X loses. In the bedroom, A lays out the photographs on a rug, like the domino pieces, and lies on the bed to look at them. And X enters. No, I think it is X. No, no, no. All bedrooms are the same, but for him the room was different. Over and over again, it as if she embraces him. Feathered gown, arms swinging back in a repeated shot, almost white against the screen. In the garden at night, the hotel slept, and X recounts how they met each other outside in silence, motionless, unable to move, backwards or forwards, that you or she was losing. Losing what? He says they cannot turn back the past. She asks him to wait until next year. He's waited too long in the hotel. A little more time, she begs, as if to leave M would be to leave part of herself. Laissez-moi. A scream that is shocking, but it is in the salon, not the garden anymore, and it is heard, not seen, though M gives A a glass of water and tells her it is nothing more than a malaise. It is nothing, and she goes up to the stairs to her bedroom. X is walking for days, for months. No, he will take her with him tonight. In the bedroom, M tells her it has been a year. He asks her where she is, but she is here, she says. And he says it is no longer true, and he cannot help her. He holds her wrist, but it is too late, and he will be alone. Everyone was at the play, but not A, who will wait until midnight if M does not come to retain her. I know this part of the film very well, for it has been my custom over 20 years to wake up here. And I was unsure, in consequence, if I should tell it, retell it, because I knew it already. She tears up a letter, the clock chimes, and we have been here before. X comes down the stairs, and they walk out, but not together, not quite. But I remembered her as being alone, and it startled me that she was not. The clock chimes. Yes, I said that. And M watches from the stairs. The garden is described, and the scene recedes. Gravel, stone, marble. At first, it seemed impossible to lose one's way. 133 minutes. It ends here. I watched the film. And when I fell asleep after I awoke, I tried to remember what I have seen. I've tried to be truthful to my memory, and I have remembered the name of my analyst.
Some questions. So, do people have questions for either Danny or Sharon?
Shall I just come forward?
Yes, please do. Come with it. It's just here. Is the mic around? Right? You get a couple more windows open.
It's very, very scary.
And some people to come with fans.
Yes, yeah, fan bearers and
moving sleeves.
Yeah.
They've been very short this year.
Okay, yes,
sir. I was just wondering on, based on something about the significance of the fragments and the fact that many of the memories...
Do you mean the Will Kamirski book? Or the fragments in general?
Yeah, I think that's the notes I've written down, so maybe it's misleading for myself. But is the significance that a lot of what we talk about and a lot of what you mentioned is based on the fact that at least some element will be false. And I may be doing this ignorantly, but is that always unintentional? And is there an element, when does it become an intentional falsification? Because earlier it was talked about withholding information that you don't necessarily want to share for various reasons. And where does that intentional, either falsification or intentional withholding of information, become an issue?
I think you should probably ask the expert. I can probably tell you that the first part of the question is difficult for me to answer. But I'll attempt anyway in a minute. When does it become an issue? I think it becomes an issue when someone when someone becomes the dupe, if you could say that, of his or her own falsification, right? If someone, and I'm talking from clinical experience here, right? But we talked a little bit about the con man this morning, and so the image that comes up now is of the person who intentionally presents him or herself as a different person, without actually being the dupe of it, that is to say, without being taken in by the charade. But it's not always the case, right? I mean, some people, unfortunately, I would say, become, I don't particularly like the word, but become the victim of their own intentional, pseudo-intentional confabulations, as a result of which, I don't want to talk about the Freudian death drive, but as a result of which, they get into trouble. See what I mean, right? The case that I described from Ernst Chris's paper could be a case in point. Right? So the young man, as Chris demonstrated to him, wasn't plagiarizing. But somehow he wanted to plagiarize. And he couldn't distinguish between how the plagiarism here was somehow driven by a certain desire and fantasy on the one hand, and it, the effects that it had on his academic career. So, I guess what I'm trying to say that if he had continued to plagiarize without getting himself into trouble, it wouldn't have been okay, but at least he wouldn't have he would not have become the dupe of his own desire. Does that make sense? Right? So he went to see an analyst because at one point he realized that, either he was going to get sacked or something was going to happen that would seriously damage his career. Now the first part of your question, being the dupe or being taken in by one's own falsifications in itself has something to do, we as psychoanalysts would say, with the work of the fantasy. With how important the fantasy is something that we use to construct our relationship to the outside world. Now, the first part of your question is difficult, and the reason why I referred to Kurosawa's film is not just because I like it or because I fell asleep during it, which I'm sure I did, but I never remember when I fall asleep. You seem to remember when you fall asleep, I don't. Anyway, we could talk about that. But the reason why I remember Kurosawa's film is that it's not a film about false memories as such, but it makes a point about human self-interest. Not that you've seen the film, but so the message that he wants to send out is about how we as human beings are driven by self-interest when it comes to representing our world to ourselves and to others. And so the characters in the film, they intentionally, we are led to believe, come up with false accounts of what happens in the woods. There's a novel that does it as well. It's Ian Pears, An Instance of the Finger Post. Do you know that came out about 10, 12 years ago? It's incredibly well crafted. So there is definitely, and Martin said it this morning as well, that there is an intentional false autobiographical memory that can be identified and distinguished and studied. As you would expect from a psychoanalyst, it's the difference between intentional at a conscious level and intentional at an unconscious level that we're interested in. Because just because you're not conscious of something doesn't mean that you're not going to do it. Okay? So you can be driven to do things without you actually consciously realizing. And that's what we call the unconscious. Okay? Now it's the boundary between the two that we're interested in. And I would say, that would be my answer to your question, that again it's blurred, you see. I would find it incredibly difficult to distinguish radically or objectively between conscious intention and unconscious intention, or if you want conscious intentionality and an unconscious drive. But maybe the experts would say something different about that. I guess what I'm trying to say is that if you come up with a story of something that's happened to you, even if you do not consciously want to embellish the story, you may still do it. Right? But at what point precisely you do it, or how these two functions interact, I don't know. I mean, I find it very difficult to distinguish.
Okay, next question. Yes, just at the back, and then we'll move to the middle.
I want to say just thank you to you both, and how I felt that the fragments that you were talking about, Danny, were demonstrated in your wonderfully performative presentation, Sharon. And to me, that is very interesting, because those fragments, those gaps in your presentation, just way out of time, and create this much more atemporal space, which is something that I'm really interested in. Yeah. And Danny, what you said about le futur antérieur, what will be in the future from present interpretation of past experience, does that, might that interpret as what will have been?
Yes.
And is that, does anybody here know, is that the future conditional tense?
It's the future perfect.
It's the future perfect.
Or future conditional. And it's what Lacan calls the logical time of the unconscious.
That's interesting, thank you.
But there is a time in the unconscious with structure like the future.
Thank you. And thank you both.
But it's the point of freedom as well, because it's at that point that you are not at the mercy of your own past. Mm. It's at that point that you are not just conditioned, determined. I mean, Freud was very deterministic. Lacan and to some extent Klein as well are much less deterministic when it comes to understanding human mental phenomena. I mean, Freud was quite extreme, to the point where he went so far as to say in the last chapter of Psychopathology of the Everyday Life that no one can come up with a number that is purely random. So he would always try to prove that what you come up with in the spur of a moment, allegedly spontaneously, is rooted in, i.e. determined by your own personal history. I think we can open a much more, how shall I say, liberating perspective. I'm very far from endorsing uncritically humanistic perspectives on human freedom and say, oh, let's all become the architects of our own future and realize our full potential as if we don't have a history that we carry with us. But I do think that that in the creative imagination there is something creative. But what exactly that means in the present can only come from the future. You see?
No, I do. And so, I think that's so fascinating idea. So it's not just time.
Yeah.
It does release.
Yeah. So there is this, we didn't talk about it this morning, but I was tempted to chip in when you said that, with certain difficulty, that an event, be it childhood sexual abuse, is not always, see, I find it difficult now, but maybe not intrinsically traumatic. That the trauma occurs in retrospect. Well, I mean, it's the Freudian idea of the Nachträglichkeit, isn't it?
So
it's the afterwardsness. I mean, it doesn't make it less severe, but it does make it more complex, and it does force us to be much more sensitive when it comes to dealing with these instances of childhood sexual abuse. Because effectively what you're looking at is not just one moment, but it's at least two moments. It's a moment when the event happened, and it's a subsequent moment when the first event acquired its traumatic quality. Right? And again, it's in the space between those two that you have to operate. Does that make sense?
Yeah. And the part of the traumatic quality might be to do with the perception that it's now framed in an external perception.
Right.
That what is perfectly, has been perfectly normal for many years and lived with, is then viewed externally as being abnormal. And that is oddly where the damage comes. Mm-hmm. And it's always a shift in position, I think.
Okay, the gentleman here was next, and then we'll take one more, and then we'll go into a conclusion.
I wonder just to what extent psychoanalysis could ever believe in the existence, I guess, of a conflict-free memory. I mean, given the emphasis on drives and affects and fantasy, the problem is, was the original event ever accurately experienced, given that it's colored by, you know, desire and feelings and emotions, as opposed to the kind of notion that, that one can make honest mistakes because we can never get the whole picture. In other words, what we perceive and what we actually experience is to some extent conditioned by the context, the previous experiences we've had, the way we're observing things. So I think there's a kind of dilemma for psychoanalysis. To what extent are all cognitive processes affected by drives and motives? Or can they actually be conflict-free, but nevertheless limited by the uncertainty of the actual process of experience and perception itself?
I don't want to bounce back the question, but what do you mean by conflict-free?
Well, that it would not be completely free from the drives, the desires, the needs of the person. Can it ever be?
I'm tempted to say no.
You could be dead. That's right, isn't it? Desire for stillness, but nothing, yeah. 0 degree.
But even if we were, Freud, I'm interested in metaphors of memory. It's a wonderful book. It's a Dawa Dreisma, I think, who wrote this wonderful book. It's an intervention in the history of science, because for thousands of years we've come up with metaphors to understand memory. And I'm really interested in that, because I think, well, maybe there isn't anything else apart from a metaphor in order to understand it. And we tend to use them to understand the brain anyway, as a whole. But so all this to say that Freud himself, somewhere in the interpretation of dreams, and it does relate to memory, compares the mental apparatus to a camera, which I think at the time, 1900, must have been just introduced. So it's not by accident that he's thinking about the camera, because he probably goes, yeah, that's got a little gadget. It reminds me of how the mind works, that kind of thing. Every time I think about it, I say, well, look, even if we were to operate in a state of subjective deadness and simply register as a camera, then that in itself would not guarantee what you call a conflict-free registration, because we all know that cameras... precisely, right? So what represents reality? We call it the real, okay? So what represents the real as it is? Can we think of anything? I don't think cameras don't. So isn't there always, to some extent, a screen? By the way, Freud doesn't really talk about false memories, to the best of my knowledge. He does talk about screen memories. But again, maybe every memory is to some extent a screen, because it's something that you put on the event or the experience in order to, as we heard this morning from yourself and from Fiona Martin, to give meaning to the event and thereby to give meaning to our own lives. But isn't that screening? As such. So the short answer is no.
Would we want to?
Well, I'm thinking, you see, if
there's, there's a wonderful story by Jorge Luis Borges. Isn't Fenion...
Funes Memorial.
It's absolutely wonderful. And it's fiction, of course. But it's a story about someone who has... perfect recall, and whose memories are allegedly entirely accurate, and he suffers tremendously. So there's also something about confabulation that probably helps us to live better. Perhaps, you know, we would want it because otherwise we would in a permanent state of suffering.
May I say something?
I'm just thinking that there are different ways of interpreting or recalling memories. So, for example, sometimes you might want to recall a memory because you just say a joke and there were other people there and there are still the same people there, so you just recall the event as it was. So if you are emotional about something and you're trying to recall something in a very emotional state, which is maybe accordant or not with the event you're trying to recall, then it's obviously emotional, so it's obviously it's going to be subjective opinion. I mean, it's going to be something that other people haven't experienced, but you are the one who has experienced it this way. So there is only always a way, seeing an event as an observer, so if you recall it in a way that everybody who was there can say that these things were said. Yes. So it depends on the way you want to recall something more than what you do at the moment.
Yeah, I mean, psychologists have done extensive research on this, and I wouldn't be able to recite many of their findings.
I think
the jury is out. I mean, it's not been demonstrated that if you're more emotionally attached to an event, you're more likely to remember it accurately.
If you're more positively positively emotionally aroused, then you tend to recall positive memories. If you are negatively aroused, then you're going to recall more easily sad memories.
Yeah, right.
It's the effect. So the thing is that apart from that, if you want to recall anything at any given time, but you try to be objective, but to be the third person, the observer, then if somebody else was there, then you can't do it. But you have to be aware at the time of the event that there is this case, so you can recall it later. So in specific events of your life, you can be emotional or try to be neutral at the same time, so you can experience from two different ways an event. So then you can recall it objectively, I think.
Yeah. Any other questions? I think let's make this the last question, and then there will be a conclusion, and we'll go to the pub.
It's not so much a question, it's just an association or contribution. I was wondering about what has been quite prosaically called intersuggestibility. But I was wondering whether there's something about the symbiotic drive, really, so that the production of memory is also a tribute to the collective. The wanting to be together, wanting to contribute and constructing something communally, even if it's an adverse memory, that it's something about intrinsic relationality rather than, because somehow I was also thinking about the act of always falling asleep at the same time in this film, where there's something about isolation or processing something on one's own, as opposed to being.
Sure. Do you want to say anything about that?
I just think that there's some research about how people will have collective memories and how people will help each other make sense of something, and it can be really very functional, and in fact people tend to research memory as an individual thing, you know, my memory for this thing, whereas in reality I think memory operates far more socially with shared cognitions and things, even I mean in two slightly different ways, like one, like I said, like how feeling connected with other people and feeling familiar and having, you know, being part of a group and all things like that. But also, as we get older, we tend to use each other's memories for different things. So, for example, I'll use my husband's memory for have I seen this film or not before, you know? and I'll use my friend's memory for have I met this person at a conference, because she's got a great memory for faces and I don't. And I've just grown up with people close to me rely almost like external hard drives all over the place. So I think that we use our memories with other people far more than is in the, at least in the psychological literature. It tends to be your own memory. And people are trying to break out of that. Like I said earlier about the research I'm doing on memory conformity is very much how people create a shared reality together.
Sharon, do you want to...
Well, I think it's perhaps very clear in the FaceTime work, in that there are two people and they're listening to each other, that the memories are told, there has to be someone to hear it. I was thinking, it made me also think about R.D. Lang's work about listening to the symptom of the psychotic patient and taking it not as taking as something that is there living and is real and must be considered as that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so, and the work I've done in the past in EMI homes, what we all fear, being alone and being in the dark. Mm-hmm. So the minute you engage and listen or talk with others, mm-hmm. something starts to return in those rather desperate places. A return of a self, a reconfigured self, a self that's partial, but nonetheless a return of what it is to be a subject.
And that can change, sorry, yeah. Between, that's and so we here. Know as well that there's audience effects, and so it depends who the person is yes. that you're engaging.
I think at that point it's a really great time to say a big thanks to Danny and Cheryl. So we're nearly done. If you would just indulge me for about another 10 to 15 minutes, I do have some final thoughts that I'd like to share with you. I remember having greenish scabs on my arms that smelled gassy and gangrenous when I picked at them, which I wasn't supposed to do, but I did anyway. There were more and more of them, pus-filled and green. And I was too young to realise how serious whatever I really had was. When I think about it now, I shudder, but I also remember how horribly attracted I was to the awful smell, like sin and death. It was really gross. I asked my mother about what disease I must have had. It must have been terrible, and she said, no, nothing like that has ever happened to you. At around 6 years old, my family and I visited relations in Australia. We took a day trip to the Big Pineapple. I remember loving it there and enjoying every minute of climbing to the top of the huge fiberglass structure to look out over the pineapple fields. When visiting the same relations recently, I mentioned the day trip, and my aunt told me that I was in fact completely freaked out by the whole place, and that I refused to climb inside the pineapple, and that I spent the whole day in tears. I cracked open an egg and it was filled with wires. I can remember being able to fly as a small child. For years in my teens, I really struggled to accept that this wasn't a real memory. I still have it with me today, memories of a number of separate occasions where I quite naturally flew rather than walked between two places. I thought that my mother left me for 2 years when I was a child to look for work. Found out in my 20s that she was only gone for 2 weeks. My mum passes a raw garlic clove from her mouth into mine in the kitchen. I remember I had a younger brother. I remember pushing him on the swings in the back garden and that he died at the age of 2. Speaking to my mother years later, I discovered that he was still born at full term plus 2 weeks. When I was young, my dad and his best friend went on a fishing trip to a very remote part of the New Zealand bush. They got lost and they somehow crashed into a tree. The story was often recollected and retold at gatherings of family and friends. Now, I always think that I remember the crash really, really clearly, as I was in the car at the time, belted in the back seat with my friend Nick, who's my dad's friend's son. It was a scary but really exhilarating experience for a child. However, I was told as a young adult that we were never there. And so to conclude, in a 2012 study on general beliefs about long-term autobiographical memory, Justice, Morrison and Conway discovered that common sense ideas of memory are either wrong or there is no evidence bearing on them and that they are inconsistent. This knowledge gap has major consequences in a therapeutic and legal setting.
So there is a clear and obvious need to present new research about memory to the public. What is also clear from over 30 years of psychological research into false memory is that under certain conditions, a substantial minority of the population can be coerced by authority figures into having memories for events that didn't actually happen, which must, in my view, have a major impact on how we collectively approach and understand our relationships with any type of power broker. Perhaps most importantly, this now clear illustration of how our beliefs and expectations can be manipulated provides the evidence, if any more were needed, for a potent rebuttal to those who would claim that any form of torture or extraordinary rendition can elicit anything other than a flawed version of events. A desire then to communicate the importance of the false memory paradigm to my audience has been a key aspect of this project. However, I've approached this ambition with a view to exploring how, as an artist, not as a psychologist, I can have a meaningful voice in this discussion. Research into false memory indicates that we all have some false memories. However, those who are defined psychologically as fantasy-prone, creative, and artistic are considered to be more susceptible, so it seems pertinent to explore how such research impacts our understanding of art. Memory has long been a subject for artists with prescient and engaging results. However, I would contest that maybe new discoveries in scientific memory research haven't yet been properly mined, questioned, and explored by those in the arts and the humanities. In a theoretical setting, works of art that interrogate notions of autobiography, self, and identity are often analysed, although not exclusively, through and a continually evolving discourse that has its roots in psychoanalytical and Freudian theory. In fact, I was first drawn to false memory research through an interest in this discourse. As we have heard today, Freud's reputation among scientific memory researchers is, on occasions, mixed, and it's reasonable, I think, to assert that speculations in his seduction theory resulted in the unintended consequence of recovered memory therapy, the oft-disputed term of false memory syndrome, and the difficulties of the memory wars. Also, the Freudian notion that we involuntarily repress our most traumatic experiences has, it would seem, had a pervasive and wide-ranging impact on the public's understanding of memory, despite the fact that the scientific study of traumatic memory has illustrated perhaps that the opposite is the case, that traumatic memory becomes a major problem when we can't forget what's happened. The memories are on constant replay, stuck on a loop, growing worse through each new retelling and through each new reconstruction. Part of my thinking then to show the false memory archive at the Freud Museum was to acknowledge this conflicting backdrop, whilst also asking if Freud displayed any degree of prescience in regard to his many writings about memory. Firstly, to challenge the two points above. It is of course vital to point out that Freud himself abandoned the seduction theory, first by letter in 1898, then publicly in 1906. Instead, concluding that the memories he had recovered through his various coercions were in fact fictions or fantasies. So it is, I think, reasonable to state that the theory's re-emergence in the late 20th century was a misappropriation beyond his control. Also on the subject of repression or traumatic memory, many would argue that the term has evolved in a psychoanalytical discourse to signify something much more nuanced than the idea of traumatic memories being involuntarily repressed. For example, psychoanalyst Phil Mollen, in his book Freud and False Memory Syndrome, published in 2000, has stated that Freud was in fact far more interested in how the repression of thoughts, feelings and desires beyond our conscious control can impact our daily lives, rather than repressed memories. He also asserts that Freud's later work was remarkably in tune with today's perspectives on memory, stating, after giving up on the seduction theory, Freud began writing his book on dreams, illustrating how the mind inherently contains the capacity for self-deception. He also wrote a paper on screen memories, arguing that memories of childhood may not be genuine memories at all, but instead later constructions. And he showed that memories can be like dreams or works of fiction, and that the subjective experience of remembering is no guarantee of the literal truth of a memory. However one decides to unpick this maze of claim and often counterclaim, I think it's important to view Freud's extraordinary, sometimes contradictory, and oft-prescient body of work about memory very much in a historical context. He should be approached, in my view, and appreciated as an exciting and engaging thinker of his time, and yet the primacy of his legacy must, of course, be questioned in light of new scientific discoveries. And I'm not sure about this point, but I think it is important that artists, curators and cultural commentators should be as ready to look towards the fascinating findings of contemporary psychologists and neuroscientists as much as they are rightly drawn to Freud and psychoanalysis and apply some of its relevance and insight to furthering our understanding of contemporary culture. And so what of that? The age of the internet and social networking provides, I think, a fascinating backdrop to research into false memory. As representations of personal identity become more celebritised, and as the private becomes more conflated by its idealised public other, the term false memory takes on a whole new meaning. On Facebook and Instagram, we're intuitively engaging in an autobiographical battleground, where the propaganda of the self has to be carefully crafted for consumption. And on Twitter, a fleeting thought that you don't really even think about can be judged and forwarded by thousands of invited and uninvited followers. How one negotiates this unending and unforgiving virtual performance has become key to our personal and professional survival. How can I be more interesting? How can the ephemera of my existence and my opinions be curated for maximum impact? How do I represent the best possible version of me? How can I make people aware of just how clever I am, or how much I've suffered, or how much I like to LOL? Maybe the fictions we create about ourselves are far more important than we'd ever dare to think. Sherry Turkle, clinical psychologist from MIT, has said, "We're developing a new personality type. It moves from I have a feeling, I want to make a call, to I want to have a feeling, I need to make a call. There's a sense of which you almost need the validation and the support of the community to in fact feel the feeling in the first place." Our smartphones and new devices like SenseCam, Google Glass, illustrate just how accessible autobiographical image making is becoming. It's no longer science fiction, given the resources we have the means now at our disposal to record every moment of our waking up lives. And yet, if contemporary research into memory shows us anything, it's that our autobiographical memories are nothing like a videotape. How do we then, as artists and professional image makers, respond to such failures in representation and the democratisation of autobiographical image making? Perhaps all we can do is highlight cliché and forms of misrepresentation. Maybe it gives us a rich new ground to create dystopic visions of the near future. Perhaps it will force us to be less self-reflexive. Perhaps the analogue and the handmade should be considered genuinely avant-garde again. Or maybe we shouldn't fret, accept the reality, join the gang, and accept that everyone can be an artist, albeit a fairly crap one. We all also have the ability to change any image to our own version of the truth. At a click of a mouse, we can shrink or expand our personal attributes, which I need to do, and add and erase who we want or don't want to be associated with. What happens when we combine these technologies to create our own versions of the truth? What happens if we alter and manipulate our own digital trail in order to mediate our experiences in a way that is a lie, but yet to us feels more like the truth? What happens when we convince ourselves that what we are seeing is a faithful representation of reality? What happens when we fall for our own propaganda? One Freudian idea that I think still resonates is the notion of fantasy, which, in my shorthand, I construe as meaning a fantasy that is taken to be real. Through the discovery of false memory and by identifying processes like the misinformation effect, reality monitoring errors, and imagination inflation, science has shown that we are in fact continually negotiating our way through truths, half-truths, and belief fabrications in order to make sense of our experiences. The paradox that an objective empirical endeavour could be interpreted as reasserting the importance of a subjective reality is for me a fascinating conundrum and brings an urgency to the question of how we attempt to understand where the truth lies in a false recollection. If we consider autobiographical memory as a creative act, and if one understands that the fictive plays an important role in understanding the formation of subjective truth, then how can we objectively attempt to identify and challenge, as we must, pathological delusions, misinformation, and damaging myths? At what point and in what context does a blend of fact and fiction break down, and in what circumstances should the two actually diverge? Is it only when our believed fictions impact on other people's known reality? The False Memory Archive touring exhibition and event series has been an attempt to interrogate these many questions and observations through a playful series of artworks, collaborations, archives, experiments, discussions and presentations. The work is an attempt to examine what role artists can have in representing scientific information to the public, whilst understanding the term false memory as a potent signifier for our times. I will, if I may, finish with a quote from the novelist and psychologist Charles Fernyhough. If we can be more honest about memory's quirks, we can get along with it better. It might be a fiction, but it's my fiction, and I treasure it. Memory is like that. It makes storytellers of us all.